This is the Florida Caribe Show. I'm Paola Baez.
And I'm Jarina Georgie.
Follow us on Facebook at WSLR Florida Caribe Show, where you can find links to the articles we are discussing and links to our previous shows.
So now we want to make a public announcement from the Sarasota World Affairs Council. They will be holding a lecture series today at 6:30 p.m. in Senior Auditorium. It should be a great talk on genocide and American humanitarianism with regards to the Armenian crisis. The talk is free. RSVP to 487-4603 or info at sarasotawac.org.
Amid police violence against Brazil's black population, a protest movement grows. On a late November night, a black 16-year-old, Roberto de Souza Pena, has received his first paycheck and was out celebrating with his four friends. After passing a military police patrol in Rio de Janeiro, police allegedly fired into their car over 111 times. The bloodshed taking place just minutes away from the friends' homes in the Morro de Lagartija favela where they grew up. After the killing, community members were outraged and poured out into the streets that very night to protest the killings. The next couple of days were filled with protests and marches in honor of the victims, causing high tensions in the city. According to the families of the victims, all of the boys had bright futures with interests in learning English, engineering, and even participating in the military. Souza's father claims that this was an execution. The majority of the victims from police killings in Rio de Janeiro between 2010 and 2013 were black men between the ages of 15 and 29. The most commonly used justification for these deaths used by police is auto de resistencia, or resistance followed by death. This classification was created in 1969 by the Brazilian dictatorship, which allows the police, if they feel threatened, to use lethal force without further investigations. In the past year, though, police killings have sparked a number of protests in Rio de Janeiro and across Brazil, denouncing racism and even having some protesters go as far as to call the current situation the genocide of Brazil's black communities. The historical relationship between the police and black communities is marked by extreme violence, criminalization, and constant human rights violations, said activist Ana Luisa Monteiro. She also was one of the principal organizers of the protest against the massacre of black youth on December 4th in Palacio Guanabara. She claims the Black Lives Matter movement in the U.S. has served as an inspiration and motivation for the Black Power movement in Brazil. So that's kind of the situation going on right now in Brazil, which is very similar to some of the things we're seeing here in the States, which a lot of people wouldn't realize that it's a very worldwide issue. And thanks to movements like the Black Lives Matter movements, people are feeling inspired and ready to take on this really big issue. Just like Ana Luisa Monteiro said, it's really inspired a lot of Brazilians to fight back against this oppressive regime that they're dealing with right now.
And it's also opening the discourse on the minorities in Brazilian society, but also the discourse of minorities throughout the world. The black population in Brazil is a big population, and they want their rights and they want conditions to be improved, and we'll see what happens. However, it really parallels what's happening in the United States. We're actually going to play a song right now by
Carla Morrison.
Yes.
Named Compartir.
Compartir. She is a Mexican alternative pop artist from Tecate, Baja California. And she's a two-time Grammy winner and is doing a lot of really cool things with her music. And we hope you enjoy it. And have a great morning.
Quiero compartir mi silla contigo. Quiero ver salir el sol y despertar. quiero caminar y correr a tu ladito. Quiero buscar y encontrarme a solas contigo. Quiero dormir y soñar caricias contigo. Quiero reír y llorar con tus ojitos. Quiero compartir mis secretos y mis suspiros. Quiero aprender a entender al mundo contigo. Pero hay una cosa que te debo decir. Y comienzo a temblar. Cada paso que das afirmas mi alma. Busco hundirme en tus ojos y en tus sentidos. Busco derramar mi querer por tus oídos. Busco rendir mi ser.
So that was Carla Morrison and the song is Compartir. Now we will go to our next story about Haiti.
Haiti's street protests. On Monday, ahead of a presidential and legislative runoff election scheduled for January 24th, about 2,000 protesters gathered in the Haitian capital of Port-au-Prince. The contentious electoral process has been beset with charges of widespread fraud since the first round of voting on October 25th. So much so that the presidential candidate of the opposition, Jude Celestin, has refused to campaign, calling the results of the first round a ridiculous farce. An independent commission created by outgoing President Michel Martelly found that a series of irregularities plagued the first round vote. Despite his findings, the commission did not recommend that the runoff be postponed. The UN, the United States, and the Organization of American States have all called for elections to be held in January. in order for there to be a new president sworn in before the constitutional deadline of February 7th. Celestine has publicly decried foreign leaders for their over-involvement in Haiti's elections, calling them hypocrites for encouraging elections to take place amidst several serious electoral problems that they would deem unacceptable in their own communities. It is as if they have one type of democracy for themselves and they would like to apply another type for Haiti, Jude Celestine says. This story is interesting in the way where they're trying to move towards a more democratic state and they're trying to improve the well-being of the country as a whole.
Yes.
But in doing so, they're rushing a process, or according to Jude Celestine, the presidential candidate of the opposition, according to him, they're saying that this process is being rushed in a way where it's not being effective because of the fraud charges and the rigged voting situation that's going on. So it's like a story of trying to improve the situation without giving it the proper infrastructure, the proper resources the country needs. They're rushing into something, I'd say, maybe.
Yes, and Haiti, as we know, has been in the news for many years as one of the poorest countries in the Caribbean, and also they have suffered through various natural disasters, and there's a lot of poverty and issues, political issues, but also economic and social issues. So we hopefully, like, we will see a transition to this new government that is fair and that is just, and that through these protests and the revolts, there is a representation of the people and their voices and what they want in the new government. Now we bring you another story, a more inspiring story, from Arizona. So Juanes and John Legend performed together to raise awareness about immigration detention in the United States. Following our last story on the detention raids of Central American refugees, we bring to you the story as a continued effort to promote immigration reform in the United States. Juanes is a Colombian musician and John Legend an American musician. They came together to perform an impromptu concert in front of the detention hall, Eloy Detention Hall in Eloy, Arizona. Juanes played the guitar and Legend the piano atop a flatbed truck with an empty desert serving as the background across the street from the detention centers. Both the Grammy winners each played two songs separately and one together, Bob Marley's Redemption Song, as a crowd of dozens of activists and family members of the detainees talked. The intention of this concert was to allow the inmates for them to listen to the concert. However, inmates were not let out of their cells, so the singers decided to tour the prison and speak to the inmates one-on-one. Francisca Porchas of Puente, Arizona, which helped organize the event, said her group's goal was for the singers to meet the detainees and families who had been fighting against strict immigration policy and raids. She said she hoped that this visit would give detainees hope. There are nearly 1,500 detainees being held in Eloy. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement said in a statement it was committed to ensuring the safety and welfare of all those in its custody. The organization transported about 60 people to the event in vans, which others drove on their own. Puente has been a vocal critic of the Eloy Detention Center over the deaths of several inmates because of suicide and medical problems. The group says immigration authorities aren't as transparent about what's going on inside the jail. Now, this brings a very interesting discussion about immigration reform, but also the criminalization of immigrants. What we said last time about using the word illegal to describe the movement of these people. Illegal, as I said, is impossible because moving across borders, being a human, is not illegal. So what this organization was saying was that a lot of these companies and private jails are profiting from the criminalization of these immigrants.
Yes, it's very interesting to see the type of reach the situation has across the world. For example, Juanes, a very famous Colombian musician, is teaming up with John Legend, another very famous American musician, very separate backgrounds, but very similar in the same way. They're both very pro-immigration reform. They're pro-decriminalization of immigrants. I think John Legend specifically one of his main causes is criminalization and the way people are treated
in the black community. For Juanes, he has a lot of focus on human displacement because he comes from Colombia, and we will later talk about him, but he comes from a country that has had a lot of forced displacement and a lot of problems. So we will actually go to our next story, which is kind of tied down to what Juanes is trying to talk about. So there's a UN involvement in the Colombian peace talks. The United Nations Security Council has moved to set up an international political mission in Colombia, which will form a team of international observers to monitor the disarmament of the Colombian government and the guerrilla group known as FARC-EP. This is a result of a three-year peace talk in Havana, Cuba, to end a long war that has displaced millions and killed nearly a quarter of a million since 1964. The UN Council decided that the unarmed international observers would look over disarmament over a 12-month period after both sides requested U.S. assistance. Since the discussion in Havana in 2012, negotiations have agreed on land rights, illicit drugs, transnational justice, victim rights, and political participation. President Manuel Santos de Colombia stated that Colombia is on the path to peace and that in the 24th of March would be the deadline for signing the final agreement. Now, the next artist that we're playing is, as we were talking about, is Juanes. He's one of the most popular Latin American singers and a multiple Grammy winner that has sold over 15 million albums worldwide. He has two Grammys, several Latin Grammys, and six successful albums. He developed his global appeal by singing in Spanish. He developed a passion for his guitar at an early age, but his music is also influenced by many classical Colombian sounds and also the tragedies in his life while he was growing up in Medellin, Colombia. He started a successful heavy metal band called Ecomosis until he went solo. He has been able to gain a lot of success, and his songs have lyrics that relay his humanitarian spirit. He's able to use his music as a social activist platform. He has a charity called Mi Sangre, which uses art and education to promote peace and help children in his native Colombia. He was honored with a Distinguished Leadership Award and has cooperated in the UNHCR to raise awareness about refugees and forced displacement in the world. I hope you enjoy the song. It's called Odio por Amor by Juanes.
Olvidamos que el amor es más fuerte que el dolor, que envenena la razón. Somos víctimas así de nuestra propia tonta creación. Y olvidamos que el amor es más fuerte que el dolor de una llaga en tu interior. Dos hermanos ya no se deben pelear, es momento de recapacitar, es tiempo de cambiar. It's time to change, es tiempo de cambiar. It's time to change, es tiempo de saber pedir perdón, es tiempo de cambiar. A pensar, la libertad no tiene propiedad. Quiero estar contigo, amor. Quiero estar contigo, amor. Quiero estar contigo, amor. Yeah. Si aprendemos a escuchar, quizás podamos juntos caminar de la mano hasta el final. Yo aquí y tú allá, de la mano hasta el final. Dos hermanos ya no se deben pelear, es momento de recapacitar, es tiempo de cambiar. It's time to change, es tiempo de cambiar. It's time to change, es tiempo de saber. Es tiempo de cambiar.
Por amor, yeah.
So that was Odio por Amor by Juanes, and Odio por Amor, Change Love, Hate for Love. It was a very impactful lyric. So now we will move on to our next story.
The Zika virus. The Zika virus. The World Health Organization warns that the Zika virus will spread most likely to all of the Americas except to continental Chile and Canada. Cases have been reported in 21 countries in the Caribbean, North and South America. The virus is spread by infected Aedes mosquitoes, and it can cause symptoms like fever, rashes, muscle pain, and conjunctivitis. It was first detected in monkeys of the Zika forest in Uganda in 1947. It remained isolated with the exception of a few cases in Africa and Asia. There was an increased attention with the epidemic of the virus in 2007 in Yap, Micronesia, 2014 in Chile, and increased cases in northeastern Brazil in 2015. The Pan American Health Organization is urging people to protect themselves against the mosquitoes. Countries like El Salvador, Ecuador, and Jamaica urge pregnant women to delay pregnancies until more is known about the virus. There is speculation that the virus has an impact in the womb and causes microcephaly, a disorder where an infant is born with a smaller brain. Brazil has noticed an increase in micropulpy in babies born and worries about the impact that this virus will have on the 2016 Olympics. And I'm not exactly sure how to pronounce that disease.
It's fine. We're not doctors.
Yeah.
We're just citizen journalists.
Exactly. So the Zika virus, be warned by these mosquitoes. Don't get, if you get bit by a mosquito and you start feeling a fever, rash, or anything like that, go get checked out by a doctor.
But I think it's also important to understand during these times of epidemics that we shouldn't be afraid to travel. I see that as a personal goal myself. There was an epidemic in Africa and so we need to be aware of what's happening, but at the same time just explore the world and just be aware.
Yeah, you know, there's danger everywhere.
Yeah,
you just have to brave the danger but also be safe. Don't do anything crazy. Moving on.
Okay, now we're going to talk about Flint, Michigan. So the Flint water crisis is receiving a lot of attention in local and national media outlets. President Obama declared a state of emergency in Flint, Michigan because the residents cannot drink the tap water. The tap water has high levels of lead because the water line was connected to the Flint River. Lead is, as you know, a dangerous neurotoxin that can cause severe health issues and can stunt growth and cause brain damage in young children. Flint residents lacked awareness about the possible health risks of drinking the tap water. Finally, in October 2015, state officials finally acknowledged that there is a high level of lead in the tap water. Now, there's a lack of awareness about this issue in the Latino community. There's no Spanish language TV channels, radio station, or Spanish-speaking services in Flint. So many Latinos who do not speak Spanish are not aware of what was going on in the community. This especially affected the undocumented community because many of the notices that had information about free water sources and precautions to take were all in English. Now, many undocumented immigrants fear opening the door to the National Guard or going to the center because they do not have a valid driver's license. There's been incidents of undocumented immigrants feeling the symptoms of this lead poisoning. However, many also do not have medical insurance to be treated. Now, people in the Latino community are taking matters into their own hands. Advocacy groups and churches are raising awareness during Sunday Mass through phone calls, word of mouth. They're handing out free bottled water and water filters donated by the Red Cross during Sunday. Mass, or any of these other community spaces. Now, Latinos in Flint are about 3.7% of the population, and among them, there's a large undocumented immigrant population originating from Mexico that do not know what's going on and fear asking help from officials. Now, Paula, what do you think about the story?
I mean, it's a very difficult situation. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of issues with it regarding health concerns, regarding the way immigration is being handled in this area of the country. I think it's important that people stay connected with their churches, with their communities, to try to understand what's going on, especially when you don't know the language, when you only know Spanish or you don't know English. Staying together as a community and reaching out to each other is important. Also, I feel like the government has a lot to answer for in this situation. I feel
yes, definitely.
There needs to be major reform in many ways, major reform in environmental sustainability, and especially, I mean, clean water has to be the most basic human need I can think of. And in a place where there is none of that, it's disheartening. But also, it's a chance for us to kind of get together and make it better and just inform each other and watch out for each other. And hopefully there'll be a resolution soon.
Yes. And, you know, that continuous theme of immigration reform kind of runs through our stories. As you see, there's a large fear in this Latino community that they cannot be helped by officials. As I explained, there's many undocumented immigrants who fear that if they go to these stations, they will be asked for their IDs. And if they don't have their IDs, they might be apprehended. So there's a lot of discussion and there's a lot of awareness of this issue in the Latino community, and people are calling and saying that, you know, you can go to the stations and still get water and you're not going to be apprehended, you're not going to be sent back, we just want to help you. Now we want to talk about an event or a trip that's being organized by Sarasota World Affairs Council. It's the same organization that brings you the event that's happening today at 6:30. They're doing a trip to Cuba, an education and cultural trip. So it's sponsored by this organization, and it will be from March 28th to March 1st of 2016. It's an amazing trip that includes round-trip airfare to Miami, all meals and beverages, a five-star hotel, luxury bus liner, and an English-speaking guide. And all the visa and airport fees are included. Now, if you're more interested in this trip, you should visit www.sarasotawac.org for further details and information. Now, we bring you a song by El Dusty, he's a producer and DJ raised in Corpus Christi, Texas. He has created a neo-cumbia musical style that blends the original cumbia rhythms with trap sounds. The song titled Anthem was written in cooperation with a Dominican twerk producer, and it's known as an anthem for the new Latino generation because it represents the mixing of rhythms from different generations and different cultures. Now, the border truly becomes electronics with this new style. We will put the song for you. It's called Cumbia Anthem by El Dusty.
You're listening to WSLR 96.5 LPFM Sarasota, WBPV 100.1 LPFM Bradenton. Here we go. Coming up, El Dusty. Cumbia Anthem. While that's going on, we're going to put the song right coming right up. We have a very important interview with a very interesting guest. Stay tuned. Her name is Itzel Alejandra Martinez. She is a 23-year-old multimedia artist and photojournalist who grew up in El Paso, Texas, with very interesting ideas about what it's like to grow up in a border town and then move to another town known as Brooklyn, New York, where the immigration populations are very diverse, and she recognizes this through her photos.
Me parece que te vi bailando un día. pasando el día. Me parece que te vi pisar a bulla. Me parece que te vi bailando un día. Me parece que te vi pisar a bulla. Me parece que te vi bailando un día. Me parece que te vi pisar a bulla.
Hope that you enjoyed that good song and it pumped you up a little bit for our interview. We're so excited to have her here. Itzel Alejandra Martinez, a 23-year-old multimedia artist, and hopefully she'll become a multimillionaire. And a photojournalist who grew up in El Paso, Texas.
Good morning, Itzel, and thank you for joining us on the Florida Caribe Show. As you know, this show is very much based on the idea of our backgrounds and how they shape us into the people we are today. So before I ask you this question, you know, welcome. Hi, how are you? Good morning.
Hi, welcome. Yeah, welcome. Thank you for having me.
Of course. So I think the first question is very baseline. How do you define your roots?
I think, you know, that's a really good question because I feel like we're you know, children of immigrants, at least I am, and I immigrated here with my mom, too, from Juarez, but I was born in El Paso, like, the border is very complex, you know. It's like I was born in El Paso, Texas, but raised in Juarez, but immigrated and came, you know, to this nation with my mom. And I feel like my roots are in Chihuahua. That's how I think I would define them in a sense. But at the same time, I feel like I can't ignore, you know, my, you know, U.S. roots as well, you know, and knowing that, you know, I'm influenced by those kinds of roots and by, you know, Tejano roots and Mexican-American roots and just, you know, various people that I grew up around and have influenced me, you know. It's like my roots are in Chihuahua, but they expand, you know. They're not just based there.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, and it's a lot about what we talk about. I think more last show we kind of touched base on it. I kind of did personally, where I had the same kind of mindset where, yeah, a lot, my whole family is from Puerto Rico, but I was also raised in the U.S. in Miami, and it's very weird having this like bicultural experience. So yeah, I really understand what you mean by, you know, in Chihuahua, yeah. But then also you can't ignore the part of you that grew up in El Paso. It's very interesting.
Yeah, no, and it is interesting. And I recently moved to New York, and I see that a lot more now, like how, and I think it's very interesting, people that maybe grew up in New York, how that, like, you know, their roots might be, you know, in Colombia or, you know, in El Salvador or in Puebla, but they're influenced, and it's like, you know where their roots are, but, you know, growing up in New York, I can only imagine, like, you know, like, being around, you know, Chinese and different people or different, even different Latinos, you pick up very different things. And then you're talking with, you know, a Mexican accent, saying Puerto Rican words and Colombian words and different kind of slang. And you're just like, wait, how does this happen? So I think it's very interesting when talking about roots and also talking about, you know, where you're at, though, you know. So, yeah.
Yeah. So the next thing I'd ask was, what prompted your move to Brooklyn? How does the culture, specifically immigrant culture, differ from Texas to New York? I know you already kind of touched base on that, but
I moved to Brooklyn about not even that long ago. I went first for an internship, and I liked it. I liked, you know, the pace of things. I liked going everywhere, seeing so many things, always something to do, movie. And then I came back to Texas, and I had to finish school, and I was like, wow, that's a little bit slower. But, you know, I took that momentum, and then I decided to move back and really try to make it work as a freelance multimedia maker and photographer, videographer, et cetera. You take on, like, various roles. And once I moved there, I've been there now, I guess, 9 months. And I'm mostly based out of Sunset Park, where I had lived. I'm not living there anymore, but I had lived for the past 7 months. And yeah, like you see, for me, it was a little bit shocking because, you know, like in Texas, it's like when you talk about Mexicans, like, you know, they're from everywhere, but, you know, mostly from like the border that came, or like Tejanos that like their families have been here forever. And before it was, you know, the U.S., it was, you know, Mexico. So it's interesting because it's like I'm used to that kind of population per se, like, you know, more Mexicans from the north. And in New York, in Brooklyn, where Sunset Park is the majority is Mexicans, but from Puebla, from the south of Mexico. So that was interesting. And then, you know, you walk 2 blocks and it's like the biggest Chinatown in Brooklyn. And then you walk another, you know, 4 blocks and there's a mosque, like, you know, so it's just like you see immigration there. And before that, there was like a big Irish community there too, you know, so it's interesting. Immigration and immigrants there, and just like the whole dynamics of like the demographics there, I think is very interesting, where there's a huge cultural exchange, you know, huge. And there's no, like, as much as there is segregation within communities, you know, like the Mexicans from Puebla try to stay with the Mexicans, the Salvadorians as well. But there's still, you know, this constant exchange. I mean, you're on the subway with like people from a million, you know, different places, different cities, and different experiences. So it's very interesting. It's been a great experience so far.
How do you think you express this feeling, this cultural exchange through your work? And more specifically, how would you describe your work?
How would I describe my work? Ooh, I've never been asked that. That's interesting. I think my work is just, I feel like, very influenced by what I'm around. So I try really, like, you know, I do photography and collage and video. And I'm part of two collectives, Mujeres en Medio and Cosmica. And, you know, we do various things and various aesthetics for both of them. And I feel like, well, my photography, obviously, the documentary is just me taking photos of, you know, what I see, what I'm constantly around, you know. So living in Sunset Park, I did a short series about different, you know, millennials living in New York. And I did a little bit of coverage of Sunset Park. So, you know, there was, like, you know, Mexicans, like I said, Mexicans from Puebla. And there was, you know, boots and you know, like these aesthetics that you see in Mexico a lot that attract me, you know, because it's what I'm familiar to. But then, you know, you go to Chinatown and you see, you know, like these signs, like neon, you know, signs in like Chinese that, of course, I can't read or understand, but they attract me. So I think that what I would describe my work as is I like a lot of colors, and I like a lot of expressing that, you know, and documenting like these very, I don't know, like this aesthetics of where different cultures come from that use a lot of colors that, you know, in their signage, just, you know, you see like signage sometimes outside and it's like with these neon signs and it's like with permanent marker that says, you know, I don't know, we need help, we're hiring, you know, and it's just those kinds of things really attract me. And I feel like they go with my aesthetic because I like colors and I grew up around colors. So it only kind of makes sense. I mean, that's like a really choppy version of what I'm trying to say, but yeah.
No, I mean, it makes sense when you think about it. You think about different cultures, you think about different people from different places, and you think maybe music, food, language, but I guess you don't really think about the actual visual representations of the different cultures. Mm-hmm. And I think you capture that very well in your... I mean, I was looking through your website and stuff. I was really interested. I loved there was one picture of all the belt buckles.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Oh, yeah. And I thought that was really interesting. And, like, I knew what it was because
I'm from Miami, but my dad lives in Homestead, which is a little bit south of Miami, and there's a very large Mexican population there. And, you know, the best tacos you ever eat in your life, I mean, besides from, like, Mexico that I've ever had down there.
Yeah.
And it's very, you know, you walk in and you know, okay, this is a Mexican restaurant, this is a Mexican attire, you know, and I really appreciate that visual aspect that you're bringing into it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it's important, you know, like, either, you know, I think for a long time, and I know, you know, that people can maybe relate to this, is that, you know, you grow up as, you know, children of immigrants coming to this nation, and sometimes, you know, you feel ashamed of where you come from, because you're ashamed, like, Western world makes you feel ashamed that you don't speak English perfectly, that you're not pronouncing things perfectly, that you don't have a certain aesthetic, that your parents might not speak, you know, English, and that you don't come from, you know, a family with education. You know, sometimes it's like, I feel like I struggled a lot with that. So right now I feel like I'm in a stage in my life where I'm just like, I'm very proud from where I come from. I'm very proud of my roots. I'm very proud of, like, you know, the people I come from. And I really want to highlight that, because I feel like for so long I struggled with being ashamed of it. And it wasn't my fault. I don't, you know, and anybody that might be going through this, it's not your fault. It's just like, you're, you know, it's like Western world telling you, like, that these aesthetics, these things, these to look out for, you know, like Prada and, like, you know, whatever else, that, you know, it makes you not want to highlight your culture or where you come from. And, or, you know, or sometimes, like, I also struggle with being pigeonholed or, like, being put in a box of, like, oh, she's, like, you know, just a Latina, like, photographer or media maker or artist, you know, and I am that. But, you know, like, we don't say that about, you know, Caucasians or, you know, Anglos. Like, they're an Anglo, like, artist and photographer, you know, like, people are informed of where they come from. And I feel like that's all I'm trying to do.
That's a very interesting perspective, and I really relate with what you're saying.
Me too, definitely. I mean, Paula has talked about her experience as growing up Latina in Cuba, but not in Cuba, sorry, in Miami.
You know,
it's Cuba, I know. But I myself, as an Albanian immigrant, had went through a very similar experience where for a long time I was ashamed of where I came from, because I was constantly in an environment where everything was American and I had to be this American to fit in. And then it slowly took time, but now I'm very proud of my Albanian roots and I'm very proud of where I came from. And it's my identity is, like, slowly forming. And, you know, there's something about identity that it's a constant flux. It's going to change with time and with the experiences that you have and the people that you come across. For example, for me, I came across a big Latino community, and the community has influenced me drastically in, like, the things that I do, the things that I, like, enjoy, the entertainment, the literature and everything. So it's a very interesting thing.
Yeah, I definitely think what you're saying about identity is very relatable, and it should constantly change. You know, it should constantly be fluid, and you change and you evolve. I don't think, you know, that's, like, the nature of things. If you're not changing, there's definitely something wrong.
So, speaking of identity, I read somewhere that you are a self-professed callejera. I would ask, what does it mean to be a callejera? What is your definition of a callejera, and how does this play into your identity?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like how do you say callejera in English? Like
street woman. Street woman, yeah. That goes out and enjoys.
I remember reading that, and I actually texted my mom. My mom is, like, my number one person I go to when I don't understand, like, something reference. I'm like, Mama, what's a callejera? And she just said, well, it just means, like, you're out in the streets a lot. Like, you're never home, and you're just walking around, hanging out with people in the street.
An active woman.
An active woman, yeah.
My mom started calling me that, like, in high school. So really, that term comes from my mom. She was like, it isn't a callejera, you know, you're always out. Like, why can't you just stay home? And, you know, like, I always, you know, like to venture out, and being home always gave me, like, a certain kind of itch. So, you know, for me, like, saying that I'm a callejera, you know, it's something that women also have been, you know, told, at least in Mexican culture or something, like Latinos, you know, like, it isn't a callejera, like a mujer que es una callejera is, like, a very negative connotation. Like, you know, like, they're related, you know, to, like, crime or, like, you know, different kinds of things that you could relate a callejera to, right? Because they're out on the street. They're not at home where, you know, like, women are supposed to be or, you know, like, this traditional mindset of, like, you know, sexism. But so, you know, to me, like, being a callejera, like, that's what my mom said. And I relate to it. I mean, I like to travel. I like to go places. I like to meet people. I like to just eat random food, try different things. And I feel like, you know, it's very much part of who I am and who I evolved to be, because, you know, like, since a little kid, you're kind of trying to, like, your parents are trying to always hold you down. I feel like my mom couldn't totally do that, but...
we understand very well. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's a very interesting identity. Good. Yeah, it's definitely, you're fighting that machista society of, like, Mexico. Yeah, that's part of the culture, but at the same time, it's how are you Mexican, yet you're a Mexican woman and, like, an independent woman. How did you deal with that, you know? That Mexican culture being, you know, more traditional and conservative, and then you're battling with that idea of being a callejera.
Yeah, I mean, I think, it's a constant battle. I don't think with myself, and, you know, I feel like I've surrounded myself around, you know, groups of people and other creatives and thinkers and just people, you know, that have, like, allowed me to be who I am without restrictions. And I feel like that's important for any creative person, to surround yourself with people that don't tell you that what you're doing is wrong or make fun of you for being artsy or, you know, whatever. But with my family, I struggle with it. You know, sometimes I've always talked back sometimes when I don't think something's right. And, you know, that's a constant struggle. But I'm learning from them. I'm also learning not to judge. You know, they come from a different kind of mindset where tradition is very important, and these things are very important to them, you know, and they hold it dear to their culture and everything. So I'm trying to be more understanding of their perspective, but I also don't want that perspective to be limiting to me. And I also know that, you know, like, you know, some of, you know, my aunts or, like, my family, you know, they're not really gonna change their ways per se, so I need to stop picking those battles, you know. But, you know, definitely without, you know, limiting me at any point, you know.
You're getting a lot of very strong head shakes here.
We're nodding. Like, we are agreeing.
In unison.
We feel you.
No, I mean, I feel like that's the struggle with, you know, like, and that, you know, this is not particular to me. I feel like this is with every, you know, community of immigrants and people that come from, like, a long tradition of different standards than the Western world, because, you know, like, it is different. It is different. And I'm speaking for myself, but I know, you know, different people can relate to it from different traditions, very custom traditions, you know. So it's hard. It's like, I don't know. I don't know the answers to, like, how do you fix it? How do you go about it? But, you know, that, like, that's my strategy. And that's, you know, kind of what I've been learning, to kind of be more understanding, which is hard because sometimes you're just like, no, that's, like, so sexist. Like, you can't do that to me right now. But, you know, it's just like, well, you know, that you have to understand, too, that they're a little bit set in their ways. And yeah.
Well, the internet has been an integral part in expanding your viewership. How would you describe the power of the internet and getting your message out there?
Mm-hmm. The internet. Wow. I think the internet is a great tool for a lot of, you know, and this is, I'm going to probably retract on what I'm saying, but I think it's a great tool for a lot of disenfranchised communities as far as the media goes, because, you know, although you still, you know, obviously have, like, you know, the digital divide between, you know, like, who has access to the internet, who doesn't, who has a computer, who doesn't. But as far as, like, how I have seen it portrayed with me, it's like I've found a lot of support from people that I don't know on the internet, from people that, you know, see what I see or can relate to what a picture I took or the vision I was doing when I did a series or whatever. And you know, it's kind of beautiful in that sense, because then you're building community. Yes, it's virtually. Yes, it's not with people that, you know, per se, like, on, you know, in real life, but it's kind of, it kind of, like, I think has helped me know that, you know, I'm not alone in this, and that there's a lot of people struggling to do the same things. And when they hit you up online, even if it's just a message saying, hey, I really like your work or something, I feel like that has helped me, like, as a creative, keep pushing and being like, okay, so, like, somebody's seeing this, you know, and you know, maybe it's just one person, I don't know, somewhere in California or in Oregon or something. And it, but it's still, you know, it's still a really nice feeling. And I feel like the internet has helped other POC and women of color, like, kind of keep creating, because they find, you know, the support, this niche community, and they're like, well, I'm going to be unapologetic about it. And that's how people grow, you know, when you're unapologetic about your work and about what you're doing, and you're not trying to front anything, you're just doing what you really understand and know, your world, you know. And yeah, I feel like in that sense, the internet has been a beautiful thing for that, for growth of creative minds that maybe did not get a platform in any kind of traditional media. That's not to say, you know, it's perfect, because obviously there's still, like I said, a digital divide, and, like, people, you know, working in this industry and people that are actually make a living out of it, it's still, you know, predominantly white and men. So it's not perfect, but, you know, I feel like it offers only a platform, and it's alternative, and people could create different mediums for it, you know?
I think, yeah, definitely, for sure, everything you said. Also, you kind of touched base on the last question, which was going to be, you know, just, you expressed interest in discussing the lack of POC, which is mm-hmm. people of color, and women's perspective in the media. And I just want to see how you thought the internet was changing that, which you just said. But also, I want to ask you about more current topic. I don't know if you've heard about the hashtag #OscarsSoWhite.
Oh, yes.
And what are your views on that? And also, you know, how the internet affects that, lack of people of color, women. What yeah. do you think? What, tell us.
I mean, I think it's great. I think in the internet, what you know, like I said, you know, there's still the digital divide. There's still, you know, Facebook. I recently, like, read some stats where, you know, like, the Facebook, Google, Twitter, and Apple, like, they still, like, have 70% men that are hired. And, you know, in the tech industry, just in general, it's, like, 85% men, over 15% women. And between that, like, there's probably even less women of color, you know? So it's very interesting to me, like, that this is like, I think that the internet is, like, changing things, but really, like it's still the makeup of, like, who is making the decisions on the internet is still, you know, predominantly men and white. But what you're talking about with #OscarsSoWhite, I think that's interesting, because I think it offers an alternative mindset as what we think of the Oscars. You know, the Oscars are, like, this, you know, academy, and, like, oh my God, this actor, this director, and, like, you know, people, like, put it on a platform, and it's, you know, yeah, you know, it's respected, you know, like, there's, you know, art that people create, and it's, you know, it should be recognized. I totally agree with that. But yeah, when you just represent one community and one perspective, like, how much are you really doing? And I think that, you know, what you're talking about, #OscarsSoWhite, is, like, saying, like, putting it on blast, like, this cannot be happening anymore. Like, and, you know, they're going to see the numbers, like, of people talking about this. And next year, something's going to change. I mean, I hope so, at least that would be strategically smart of them to change it, you know, because this can't be happening anymore. And I feel like with the internet, you see the numbers of people talking about this. You see, like, you know, the feedback on this, and it's, like, it's astonishing, because the demographics are changing, and they have changed, and we're here, and, like, they can't keep ignoring us, you know? So I think, you know, in that sense, like, the internet has helped put, like, certain issues and platforms, like, on blast, where they go viral, because, you know, a lot of people are thirsty for this, you know? A lot of people want this. And it's just because, you know, the top media makers aren't, you know, really recognizing it. It doesn't mean it doesn't exist, you know. So I think that's very interesting. And it also provides, like, a different alternative to, like, the record of what we're going to think of Oscars 2016, you know. Like, this will definitely be, I mean, if there's a journalist writing about this, they have to include this, you know. So it's interesting, yeah.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you on that. There is a interesting perspective on the people of color that are not represented yeah. in Oscars, and the artists and musicians, and not only Oscars but all media that need to be represented and need to be awarded for their accomplishments.
So mm-hmm. I think if I had to sum up this show we just had, I'd say the word would be reformation, immigration reform, yeah. identity reform, Oscar representation reform,
transnational,
yeah. trans, you know,
between borders.
Between borders. So yeah, let's hope for
the impact of social media on social movements.
Mm-hmm. Let's hope for some, you know, reformed views in the world. And thank you so much for talking to us, Itzel. We really enjoyed having you.
It was a pleasure.
No, thank you for having me. No, it's been great. You all are doing great work. And I'm really happy to see, you know, more of these shows coming up. So it's great. Keep it up.
Thank you so much. And now we're going to play a song that you asked us to play.
Yes.
Would you like to introduce it?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So this is Copulita, and it's with Chancha Viz Circuito, and he's an Argentine producer from Buenos Aires, and he kind of, you know, talking about these fusions and all these things, he kind of is taking these like folkloric songs and acoustic drums and beats and mixing it with like digital sounds and electronic music. And and the song is very beautiful because I kind of wanted to relate it to what we're talking about here, and it's a song that speaks about getting rid of toxic vices and old ways. So I feel like, you know, we're talking about getting rid of, you know, like these kind of mindsets that set us back. I wanted to bring this song, and it's a very beautiful song.
All right, thank you so much, Itzel, again. Here we go. This is Coplita. Everyone for listening. That was Florida Caribe Show. We're going to put a link up on our Facebook page, WSLR Florida Caribe, for you to be able to see Itzel's work. Also,
if you want to hear the podcast again, it will be also on our Facebook page. It was a pleasure having Itzel on our show, and we hope you enjoyed the show.
And adios.
So we'll talk to you guys next week, or no, the week after. Bye.
Okay. Oh,